Parsons, you're listening to No Names, All Game.
All right, guys, welcome back to No Names, All Game, your go-to Penn State football fan podcast. I've said it once, I've said it 100 times, I'll say it again. We are fans, we're not journalists, we're not experts, we're not even professionals. Just a couple of guys who love Penn State football, love talking about Penn State football. We love talking about it with you guys, and we love talking about it with each other. And on that note, joining me as usual is my co-host, Sweets. How are you today, Dan?
Pat, happy new year. Happy 2024. New year, but same professionalism from you, good sir. I'm happy to hear it. Happy to see it. I hope you had a good celebration. I hope you got some time away from everything. But we never take time away from Penn State football, regardless of bowl outcomes, regardless of what's happening. We come back and we need to bring it to the people.
Yes, I did not have a good New Year's. I woke up on December 30th, pretty sick, and then the performance in that game did nothing to help. And then I ended up actually in the hospital on New Year's from
said
illness.
In the hospital?
Yes, I fainted in my own bathroom.
Oh my gosh.
Went to the hospital. But, you know, things have gotten better for me since then in terms of my health and Penn State football news. So I think the two tie together, and we'll dive into we'll start with the bad, the ugly, and then work our way towards the good in this episode, which means we're going to be starting with that bowl game that was borderline torturous to watch, I would say. You know, Penn State loses by what, like 14 points, but honestly, it was not that close. Mm-hmm. It was a bad game. It was everything about kind of Penn State's offense that you hated during the only times we played good teams this season. Offense looked totally ineffective until the game was out of reach. And, you know, I think the toughest part for me was that the game started off so well. Penn State's mm-hmm. defense absolutely shut down Ole Miss. Looked like it was about to be a very long day for Jackson Dart. And then the offense comes out and moves the ball really well on their first drive, but settles for a field goal. And that kind of felt like an omen for things to come for the rest of the game.
Yeah. You know, looking back on it, it's really, in some ways it's a strange tale of halves. I mean, definitely not perfect at any point in the first half, but a very competitive back and forth battle where you felt like, yes, Penn State's defense was giving up more than they normally would, but the offense was definitely finding some success. And even with the interception, you know, the game was 20-17 at half, and it really did feel like this was anybody's game going into halftime, even with the mistakes Penn State had made, even with some of the, you know, back and forth. Both teams found some stops, both teams found some success and some big plays. I mean, that was throughout the first half. There's some really big plays coming from both sides of the ball. And then, Pat, that third quarter. You know, I did a quick breakdown of yardage by quarter. You know, first half over 100 yards, second half over 100 yards. Third quarter Penn State offense, 14 yards total. I believe that's a result of three and outs. One at 4 yards total, 9 yards total, and 1 yard total in those drives. And that's when the game went from 20-17 to 31-17. And then, yeah, like you said, fourth quarter, too little, too late type of situation. Just took it out of reach. And we've seen that happen with the Penn State offense throughout the year, where they have some success, they have some plays, but then they can just stall out completely and start giving the ball back. And the defense, in this case, gets both tired and in a lot of ways outplayed, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, this was not the same defense that, you know, we were used to throughout the season because of opt-outs. You know, Chop not there, Johnny Dixon not there, Kalen King not there. I think those were the three big ones missing.
I believe so, yeah.
That was a huge difference, man. Having those corners, I think Penn State could have overcome the absence of Chop Robinson, but to add him in there with, you know, your pretty much shut down corners, like, it's a very good core of wide receivers from Ole Miss. I mean, those guys are legit playmakers. It made a massive difference. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that Penn State wins this game if there are no opt-outs or anything like that. We don't know that. But I think it's fair to say that it's a much more competitive game and a much different looking game if, you know, two NFL caliber cornerbacks are out there on the field.
Yeah, mix that in with Diaz obviously having departed and yes, put together some of the game planning and whatnot beforehand, but it makes a huge difference because you could see that, you know, they tried to keep some of that same aggressive style at times, throwing blitzes in there and everything else, but Jackson Dart just started to see it. He saw it before the play, he saw it during the play, and all of a sudden you saw them getting the ball out to their guys in space one-on-one, and that's where all of a sudden your scheme isn't working. And then you multiply that by, like you said, your effective guys who, you know, as much as we like to we have our you know, issues or we bring up the challenges throughout the season, those guys are sure tacklers and those guys can stay in front of guys and we're not letting up a lot of big plays throughout the year. And we saw guys get beat one-on-one regularly throughout the game, specifically on the edges. And so you mix in a scheme that got figured out and got beat, especially in that second half, you know, with guys getting just straight up beat because A, they're just not our, they weren't our regular starters, or B, you're playing some of the best wide receivers we saw all year, you know, in terms of a core, probably outside of Ohio State. That's the best, you know, that's the best group. And maybe even including that, the way they played was really, really impressive. And that just made it a long day for the defense.
Yeah, I think, you know, considering Abuka was out when we played Ohio State, I think this wide receiver core certainly had more depth. And where you really saw the difference, I think, with the opt-outs at corner were, you know, Jackson Dart starts getting rid of the ball super quick. That's nothing new for Penn State's defense. They've dealt with that all season. But he wasn't having to get rid of the ball quick and settle for like 2 to 4 yard completions. He was still throwing the ball 10 plus yards downfield. Their wide receivers were just beating our cornerbacks. I mean, it was Daquan, Cam Miller, and Zariah Fisher. Was that who was out there playing corner for most of the game?
Yeah, Zariah Fisher was out there. I mean, they were rotating a couple of guys in as well, you know, and rolling guys down from the safety spot. You know, obviously Winston was in there. Wheatley was rolling into some slot play here and there. They were really trying to get a lot of guys on the field because, I mean, Ole Miss was rolling out spread 4 or 5 wide a lot to try to neutralize that pass rush. And I mean, that ended up with, you know, only one sack, which I think across the entire season, there was only maybe one other game where Penn State's defense didn't come up with more than one sack throughout the entire game. So yeah, really, really found a way to neutralize that. But you're right, it wasn't just quick hitters, it wasn't just little screens. I mean, these were 10, 15 yard slants and crossings and outs that they were just getting open and making plays on the ball quite regularly, you know, throughout the game. Sometimes running wide open, which feels like when you're in the type of, you know, coverage that they were in on some of these zero blitz schemes and everything else. I mean, yeah, I could see guys breaking away, but not like uncovered with just grass in front of them. That just felt off. You know, and credit to Ole Miss's, you know, their play calling and their scheming, but also just their players for just making plays.
Yeah, and I don't know how you, I, did you get to like, for, you know, from Australia, were you able to tune in?
So I was streaming what I could. I ended up mostly going back and watching the film on replay as I was having some issues with accessibility, being in the Southern Hemisphere and out of country. But you know, so I didn't get as much of the commentation, you know, commenters and everything else, but I got to pretty much watch all the playback tape, you know, as I went through everything.
Yeah, I won't lie to you. I actually turned the game off after the third quarter. I kept it up like on my phone, but I was just watching TV. That was not that because it was so painful to watch. I hated it. But when I, you know, watched the meat of the game, I was somewhat impressed with Cam Miller at cornerback. You know, there's no one I want to throw under the bus, but there were a couple of guys who were getting torched out there at corner, just like. Like you said, leaving guys wide open. Cam Miller, who I think kind of got picked on all day and targeted, you know, at least he, in my opinion, was making these catches competitive. The wide receivers were making plays on him. But he was making them make the plays at least. He was not leaving guys wide open. He made it difficult. And like that to me is a much better sign than guys blowing assignments or just like
Right.
letting dudes get absolutely,
Yeah.
uncontested catches.
Yeah, I'm in some ways you can really live with that. I mean, these are competitive Ole Miss players that were making these types of plays against, against Bama, against, other SEC competition. Not so much against Georgia as we talked about leading into this one, but I mean they were still, they put up really good numbers throughout the entire year. So no love lost on guys putting up competitive battles and just, getting outplayed in the game when they just don't have the experience against guys like that to come down in a 50-50 situation. I mean, that's just sometimes that just is what it is. But, as much as the defense was a bit of a shock of giving up that many yards, the run defense was still surprisingly effective. You feel like the game maybe not so much, and obviously they ran the ball at the end of the game to just kind of kill clock. But I mean, 47 carries from the Ole Miss rushing, their total for only 146 yards. That's coming in at under 4 yards a clip, and I mean,
Three.
they really ran it through under three. Is that
It's
really under
right.
three?
It's right at 3.1.
Rated three, yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, Judkins had a solid game, but his long was 18. He didn't have any touchdowns. This was really, again, as we just noted, just a lot of guys winning with scheme and in one-on-one situations on their receiving side, and that making the defense pay. So again, it was a little bit of everything, a little bit of missing, our guys that opted out, and just not having Diaz there to make halftime adjustments as we've seen them do. I mean, notoriously, our defense in the third quarter had not given up a single point until that Michigan game, and this was one of their worst third quarters of the entire season, bar none. And yes, playing good competition always will do that, but I think seeing that their mistakes got highlighted in the third quarter versus fixed is a big part of where you'd see a coach like Diaz who could make the adjustments versus not in this particular game.
Yeah, and honestly, to me, the defense was disappointing, but you kind of understood it. What killed me was that offensive performance. There weren't many opt-outs on the offense. I think it was only Olu. But you would have thought the entire wide receiving core opted out of the game based on the way it went. Not a single catch from a wide receiver until about halfway through the third quarter when Liam Clifford caught like a 10-yard in or something. I mean, listen, the wide receivers were not good. The passing game was horrendous. 75 of the, 295 passing yards came on like a 1 yard pass play to Tyler Warren. That was nothing special in the pass department. And then, another, it's, I got frustrated at one point and tweeted out that there needed to be a quarterback change. Of course, shortly after that, Bo Prabula throws like the worst pass of the game when he's 12 yards behind the line of scrimmage. So re really got what I asked for on that one. The only, to me, the only bright spots of this game were on the offensive side were Nick Singleton and Tyler Warren. I mean, Catron Allen played, he played well for sure. Nothing that was game changing, but he was good. Nick Singleton looked really good to me. Tyler Warren looked great. Outside of that, it was a whole lot of bad.
Yeah, I mean, if we were doing our traditional awards, I think we probably would have split our lines between Warren and Singleton. Because realistically, if we're looking at the way that we got any of our passing yards, it was all yards after catch type of stuff. Like you said, the Warren one for 75 was a pretty bad pass into a lane that got tipped. He made a great concentration effort catch and then just turned it on downfield. And similar, I mean, Prebula bought some pretty good time on the Singleton touchdown. But again, he made a nice catch and then just turned on the jets and, and found open space. So, realistically, those two guys really made a lot out of not that much at times in the passing game. And then, yeah, I mean, just looking at the wide receiver numbers again, Wallace with four catches, Clifford with three. And then it's all tight ends and running backs. Dinkins, Johnson, and Warren account for, nine or eight, and Singleton had another four. It's just amazing to not see more wide receivers at this point in time. still can't find a way to show up on the stat sheet, and just in other ways. I thought we would lean a little bit more on the rushing side. I think we finished with some pretty solid numbers overall in terms of efficiency. I think 6 yards a carry is where it ultimately ended up, 167 yards. I really just got to that point in the third quarter, though, where all of a sudden
You
you
couldn't
go
run
from
the
a really
ball.
close game to being down multiple possessions, and they just had to start throwing.
It would have been great if that offense could have kept running the ball, but they put themselves in a position where they had to pass. And I mean, only two wide receivers with catches on this game is embarrassing. If I remember correctly, most of Harrison Wallace's production came in garbage time, when the game was out of reach at that point, where, you were scoring a touchdown just to get it to two scores. That's like kind of who cares. I mean, a disappointing day for the offense, for the pass catchers, for Drew Aller, I think for sure. I mean, do you want to get kind of, I think maybe we should save that for kind of the larger picture stuff at the end of the episode. What do you think?
Yeah, I think overall that it does go towards the bigger picture. I think we as fan bases who haven't gotten into the CFP have wrestled with the idea of the importance of these games and what can you gain by them, especially with opt-outs and coaching changes and everything else, which again, like you noted, goes to the bigger picture of where we're heading and trying to bring relevance back to those kind of post-seasons because these bowls become very imperceptible of the same team you watch during the year sometimes. In our case, it was more on the defensive side versus the offensive side, which is frustrating in and of itself. I think for Ole Miss, honestly, this was mostly their entire team in 2023, though.
I
I
think they
think
had
we
one opt
talked
out.
about, what was that?
I think they had one opt out,
They had one, yeah,
edge rusher.
exactly. And so for them, it's definitely a much better, a much better gauge of look in the mirror. I think their full coaching staff was, for the most part, I think stayed around as well. So just a situation where you're trying to gain what you can out of it from players we know are going to be, of course, major contributors and starters next year, but also possibly, a fully new offensive system, right? A fully new set of players in certain positions and trying to kind of figure out what that's going to look like in a year versus in the 3 weeks they had to prepare for this game. And, we can only go so deep into analysis on the actual game play by play versus, all right, a guy like Singleton looked like he had kind of gotten back into his form in the open field, and found some really great plays. Warren, we know, is staying and is going to be the kind of linchpin on the tight end side. And yet we still sit here trying to figure out wide receiver, but of course we don't get our transfer portal guys in until after the bowl games. A whole nother topic that we're going to talk about, but it does. It changes what the team's going to look like. So gain what we can and yes, be frustrated. It's always nice to come away and would have been great to win the Peach Bowl and then have the gauntlet of wins in the bowl games for the various New Year's Six bowls, but at the same time, credit to Ole Miss. They played a great game and honestly were a really good team. And their two losses are very representative of the fact that they were kind of right outside of that top four.
Before we move on to kind of, some news outside of the bowl game, you touched on a little bit. I don't buy into this whole, bowl games are meaningless thing. If they're playing a football game, I'm sorry, it matters. It matters to me as a fan, so I feel like it should matter to these players. I again, I'm not gonna sit here and bash anyone for opting out. I'm not gonna pretend I don't understand it and that it might be the best decision for the guys who do it, but I'm also not going to pretend that I'm a fan of when guys do it. I'm not going to sit here and pretend it doesn't make me look, at some of them a little differently. There are some guys where you go, I whatever, I get it. There are other guys where you go, I don't like that decision, rubs me the wrong way. I'm not going to lie to you, and maybe that's unfair, but I don't think I'm tired of this like narrative that the players don't like owe the fans anything, like to even play in the game, or that like these games are meaningless, why should they play in them? All right, if they're meaningless, why did they suit up for any of the games after we lost to Michigan? How come? What was the point?
Yeah.
What was the
Right.
meaning in those games? We were out of the playoff. Why suit up? And
Right.
you know what? If you want to say that you don't owe the fans anything, that's fine. But then they don't owe you anything. And that certainly doesn't extend to them, like, showing you any kind of grace when you decide to opt out of the bowl game. If you owe them nothing, they owe you nothing right back. Like, if that's the relationship you want with the fan base, that's fine. And I'm not going to pretend that your NFL future isn't more important than what a college fan base thinks of you. I know that it is. But let's also stop pretending that the decision to opt out of a bowl game isn't the selfish one. It might be the right one. It very well may be, but it's also the selfish decision. And let's stop pretending just because you put out a graphic and said thanks at the beginning that it isn't.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I don't, the amount of time and in a lot of cases money that gets invested from, from the fans, definitely, not just a game to game basis from, but from all the alumni who attended school, which builds up the program and then pays for the stadium, pays for the facilities, does all that level of things. There's absolutely a back and forth there. And yeah, there's emotional input that goes into it. I totally agree with you. I think there can be a mutual parting of ways, which is a thank you for being fans and support. Respect, I'm going to do this. And you're right. You can say, okay, thanks. We appreciate it, and then move on. But you're right. There doesn't need to be an overstepping of ownness after that. I think it can be a mutual separation in an area like that. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely there's sides to it, right? Especially as we start to look at, the way that NIL deals and everything else are going to get put together, there should be bowl levels of incentives and things of that nature. If you don't play in a bowl game, regardless of it being college football playoff or whatever type of bowl game that is, I mean, think about if someone decided to not play in, I mean, you don't want to compare it yet, but in the NFL, you would get docked. You don't get
Yeah.
money if you opt to not play in a game. That's how they work. And if they're going to start to structure these contracts for NIL and everything else, then if you decide to not play in a game, the whole point of you getting paid was to play for the team and to be a player that supports that program and that brand. By you saying you're opting out, you're saying, I am no longer associated with this brand in terms of being an active player. I have moved on to my professional career, and that's fine, but that's where there should be a level of, okay, well, you support, we supported you all season, we paid you all season. You're not going to follow through into this postseason, which is what bowl games are.
Yeah.
And that should probably have a repercussion to it. And again, that might be the financially good decision for them, like you noted, but it should have something around that tied to it where players don't feel that they can have both. They can have everything they want being a college player and getting NIL deals, and then also make the decision to leave without finishing the season. So there's pro that's probably going to start to become something that these different businesses or whoever that is start to build into it, because it does matter. It matters to the fans, and it matters to those people who are making the deals.
Yeah, and let's also be honest about NIL. It's largely speaking fan money. You know, this is not the NFL where you get a contract and then
Right.
the organization pays you. That money is raised from the fans. I get that in a roundabout way it is in the NFL as well, but NIL money from the most part is just coming from people who like the team. So there's
Very
that.
true.
And I do also want to clarify, I will have never and will never be like, hey, fuck this kid for opting out. And like, he's not a Penn Stater, and like, I disown him as a fan. I've never felt that way. I don't now. But I, again, I also won't pretend that it doesn't rub me the wrong way. And I also don't like the narrative that like you see on Twitter sometimes where like people come after you for getting upset about an opt out. No, you have every right to be upset about the fact that someone quit on their team.
Yeah, I mean, there's, and there's examples of guys who chose to do it in an interesting way, right? Like, I think back to Saquon Barkley's junior year. He knew he was going to be a top 10, probably top five draft pick at the end of that season. They didn't get into the CFP, but they got into a bowl game. And basically what happened was he did this split game with Miles Sanders where they split the backfield in split series. He still got a chance to be there with the team and go into the game while handing it off to the next guy on the team, but he still contributed into that win. I mean, obviously you can remember the 92-yard bowl game run in that one, but like it was a way to still be part of the team, finish out the season, but also be cautious and not put him in a position that would risk his future either. It was an interesting kind of balance for a guy that He could have walked away the second they weren't a CFP contender anymore, and he would have been fine going to the NFL. And honestly, the fans wouldn't have hated him either because he was so well loved, right? But he wanted to do that in a specific way. And I just, there are definitely creative ways to do it. And there's ways to think about that to finish out with the team, be there for the team, but also, you know, protect your future. And I think some guys have done it creatively, other guys, you know, maybe not so much. So I don't know. You look at an example like that and you're like, it can be done and you can do it in the right way and in a way that still protects yourself. But I get guys not wanting to take the risk too. So yeah, it's
But also, you know,
plenty will happen in the future.
that is why Saquon Barkley, you know, part of the reason why he is looked at the way he is and why so many people consider him one of their favorite Penn State football players ever. You
Right,
know, there's a
right.
reason he's as popular as, and it's not just because he was good.
Right.
So there is that. But we'll move on to some other stuff. You know, big news in the transfer portal for Penn State right now. Number of guys have left. Luckily, no one who is a major contributor. I would say biggest names are Christian Driver and Dante Cephas. The Cephas news, I think the writing was on the wall as soon as what might be the biggest news for Penn State broke. Julian Fleming coming back home to Penn State. This is a big one. This wide receiver room was, you know, we touched on it, in trouble, in this bowl game and for much of this season. You know, Julian Fleming has not been ultra productive at Ohio State. He's been, you know, battled some injuries, been more of a role player, like third receiver, I would say, for most of his career. But you know, he has also been buried by some absolute stars. I think what you do like about him is that he's going to bring, I think, an amount of leadership and effort to this team that this wide receiver core needs. One of the underrated things everyone talks about with him is how good of a run blocker he is. That might be the kind of guy we need in this room to, even if he's not putting up, you know, 1,200 yards next year, maybe he helps raise the bar of competition and effort in that room to help the development of some of these younger guys. And I think at the very least, he has the potential to be the outside receiving threat that Penn State was missing this season.
This one's going to be really interesting. I feel like it's one of the first times that a guy from an elite program who's been buried and kind of was just around so much other talent that it wasn't necessarily that he wasn't good enough. It was just that so many guys around him were legit first round draft picks, that he's leaving and going to another program that's kind of, I guess we would, you know, we have to consider ourselves that like kind of one tier below.
We are. Like, listen, Ohio State's been to the playoff multiple times. We haven't beaten them in
So
7 years.
we do have to do that without, it's not a knock, right? But it's true. And it's going to be really interesting to see what kind of mentality and attitude he brings to the room, right? Because he's not going to come in and be like, I'm the alpha, you know, everyone targeted me constantly, you know, I deserve X amount of targets a game. But he is going to bring an interesting perspective of like, how did Ohio State's wide receiver room function and work? And how did they think and get feels for the games and the way they attack defenses? Because, I mean, yes, some of it is just pure talent, but I mean, you can't deny what Hartline had done with that room and the way they develop receivers there and what they bring to the table. And I'm wondering what that maturity and that mental aspect that he brings to the table is really going to look like. You know, how did guys like Olave and Wilson and Marvin Harrison Jr., how did they approach the game? What did they think about? What did they bring to the table as all of them were, you know, putting together their plan and the way they ran routes and the way they attacked defenders? It's going to be interesting to bring that into the room because the opposite side is a guy like Cephas who dominated to an extent at a lower competition. And then when you bring him into the room, he's got to learn. He's got to figure out how to fight against guys that are this elite level at cornerback and safety and these different defensive schemes versus a guy that's been seeing it and studying it and working with guys that do it so well that he's now bringing in more knowledge and experience into this room than anybody else has. You know, and I think that's going to be really interesting to see how much that could be really beneficial to not just the team, but to the rest of the wide receivers in the room.
Yeah, and I think part of the issue that plagued Penn State's wide receiver room this year was that it felt like all of our best options at receiver were really slot receivers. You know, Keandre Lambert-Smith, Trey Wallace, Liam Clifford are really more slot guys than they are outside guys. And admittedly, like Julian Fleming, because of who else was in that Ohio State room, has mostly played in the slot at Ohio State as well. But coming at 6'2", a little bit bigger, he at least has the body type to be an outside guy, and so you hope he can step into that role. I'm not going to sit here and say he's a slam dunk, but there's a lot of potential there for him to improve that room and step into a role that Penn State just didn't have anyone significantly in this year. And that's big.
No, he definitely fits a role. I don't think that he's a duplication, and I think the skill set he brings is also pretty unique as well. It's an exciting add. I think coming from a rival-ish program in the same conference is always going to be interesting as well. Because you never say that he's going to be like, okay, this is how we compete Ohio State, right? Like, that's not what you're hoping or saying he should have to do. But he does know how they practice. He does know how they think. He has, I mean, he's ran routes against cornerbacks that are going to be starting for Ohio State next year. So that does also bring another element to the fold. That's going to be very interesting with him. And it's exciting. It's good to see some of this talent trade, in college football benefit us a little bit. And we'll see how he kind of slots into this offense, I think fairly quickly and fairly easily, to be quite honest. Should be a quarterback's best friend because he's also very consistent in kind of his hands and route running from what we've seen, but just in general from what the talk was while he kind of left out, for the transfer portal.
Yeah, and second big name to come in is a guy who I think very similar profile to Julian Fleming, Nolan Rucci, former five star out of PA, kid who Penn State just missed out on, coming from inside the Big Ten. He hasn't quite panned out at Wisconsin. He hasn't put up anything big, but that potential to be elite is there. I think they're going to get an extra year of eligibility with him than they do with Julian Fleming. And he's viewed as a little bit more of a project. But you're talking about a 6'8 lineman, 200, 300 pounds, a guy that Penn State wanted very badly. And I think at the very least is going to be an important depth piece for an offensive line that is losing Caden Wallace and Olufashano.
Yeah, I feel like every single year we see how important O-line depth is too. It's just like it constantly feels like at least one player gets dinged up, at least one guy has to move from tackle to guard or swing around another way, or they need to build in these different packages or something else happened. At the beginning of our season, we had that O-line switch up because a guy couldn't play for the season, right? Medically, was unable to play. So
Yeah.
you just It's never a bad thing to have a ton of good linemen in the room. And if you can add both known talent as well as guys that are even considered a project, the one thing Penn State knows how to do is get guys into the strength and conditioning program and get them to a point where they can, they can hit, block, run, and put something athletic on the field. So definitely exciting to continue to bolster that and make sure that they have depth at almost every spot on the line.
Yeah, I mean it's injuries on the O-line are something that I think get overlooked because these guys are not generally dealing with the massive hits that you see on TV. They're not making these cuts that result in torn ACLs that look so tragic, but like the injury rate on an offensive lineman is literally 100%. Like these guys are just never healthy because it is a brutal position and they're spending the entire game just getting nicked up and rolled on and hit, and it's not an easy thing to do. So yeah, O-line depth is always going to be really important, especially after losing, two really veteran presences on the edge.
Definitely. Yeah. So it's good to see that they're going after positions that they critically know that they need help at. Wide receiver, O-line, and the defensive backfield obviously is one area that they're still figuring out. I think they've got a pretty good group there. But it's always good to be adding guys yet again because you're running a lot more nickel and dime and all of these different coverages, and it's good to get guys with different skill sets coming into the room as well to add.
Yeah, and I mean, That defensive backfield has been so good for so long, it feels like. And it was hard to watch that bowl game where they really got exposed. But Penn State, I think, saw that too and went into the portal and adds AJ Harris from Georgia.
Right.
Former high four-star recruit, very good player. From what I have heard from, people who scouted him, I believe he has 3 years of eligibility left, and he's a little bit more of a project. Again, he might not be a guy who comes in and starts right away. I mean, he might be because, high four-star recruit, those guys are, here in a program at like Georgia, there's always potential for that. But I think he's being looked at as sort of like a Johnny Dixon type guy who maybe doesn't start his first year in the program, but then has two extremely productive years after that. I mean, this is a for Penn State to get a guy from Georgia has been a little atypical of what they've done. They've kind of looked at guys like this as, and James Franklin's openly said, we don't want guys who weren't good enough to hack it somewhere else. I don't know if that was a perception thing that he was, didn't want to be known as that program, but they certainly changed their tune there, adding a probably an important at the very least depth piece in the defensive backfield in order to bolster what's going to be a very young, very thin room next year.
Yeah, I mean it's I don't know. Couldn't hack it elsewhere. Couldn't cut it. Just feels kind of ungenuine because you never know what situation a player is going through.
Hey, his words.
I know. I hear you. I hear you. I like. It's not always a talent thing. Sometimes it's a scheme thing. Sometimes it's injuries. Sometimes it's just, you had a bad couple of games and something happened, and then another player stepped up and played really well, and they just got the opportunity. And you just never quite got back on the field for some reason. I mean, that happens all the time. And I feel like I'm sure he doesn't look at it that black and white. But if you are to do that, I think that's the wrong approach to take, especially in the college football landscape nowadays. If you want parity and you want to be able to compete, sometimes you got to take a guy that didn't quite fit the square hole because he's a triangle and find a triangle placement on your team because he's that talented or that good. And this feels like that type of situation in my mind. And I'm hoping that that's how it works out because I think that would be a huge, huge bolster to continue to, like you said, keep that very high level of play that we've had through our defensive backfields in the last really, more than half a decade, I'd say. But definitely recently.
Yeah, and I think that was more of like Coach Franklin kind of setting the tone for how we're going to treat the transfer portal. I don't think he wants to be like a program that is constantly pillaging the portal for guys. I think he wants most of this roster to be built off guys that he recruited and came here first. And that's just kind of like the vibe he was putting out there. But Penn State does, I think, just yesterday bring in a guy who can be, a day one starter at cornerback with Jalen Kimber from Florida. I think he only has 1 year of eligibility remaining, so the plan is going to be for him to come in and start right away. I was watching, our friends over at For the Bloggy did a great little breakdown of what he brings to the table, and he is a legit cover cornerback, man. This guy is an athletic freak. He's got incredible measurables with stuff like, vertical and shuttle and his speed. Like elite level of athleticism, all there. Not super physical, and he does not tackle. He
Ha
has, I'm talking about like a Deion Sanders level of interest in tackling, which I do think will have to change a bit in this Penn State program. Good news is that, like for the blog he mentioned in their video, he is enrolling in spring, so he's going to get, a lot of time with Coach Losey. And this Penn State staff to both, physically build him up a little bit and maybe mentally get him to realize the fact that he's going to have to do some run fitting in this defense if he wants to be part of it. But, we saw some of the coverage issues that Penn State had in this bowl game with the guys who are going to be stepping into this role next year. So I think to bring in a guy who can cover elite wide receivers is very important.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, you never like to hear is not physical, but at the same time, one-on-one ability to blanket and cover is, that's something that sometimes, honestly, you can't teach. Some guys just have a better feel for movement and reading the way that guys play off the line and run their routes. And, you know, to find a guy that can do that naturally and then pull them into a system and then, of course, you know, hone and train them and everything else. Yeah, that can be a huge, huge benefit to have a guy that you can rely on like that, where if you've got a guy that you know is coming in, you need to keep someone on him. It's nice to have that in your back pocket.
Yeah, and you know, I believe the transfer portal window, you know, this portion of it is closed for now, so you probably won't see any new names added anytime soon. Maybe some, I think it extends a little bit for, you know, people in the position like Alabama who just lost a coach. So maybe some guys go in there, but I don't think Penn State's going to be looking to add a huge number of guys after this. But you know, I'm sure that some names will trickle in, especially at wide receiver, still maybe still a little bit in the defensive backfield. If any high profile edge rushers come on the market, they're always going to be looking at those guys, offensive tackles, guys like that. But it seems like Penn State locked up a pretty good core of guys early, which has been a little rare for them in the transfer portal era, and so that feels very good. We do want to move on to a little more like kind of 1,000-foot view of Penn State football program, for next season and like and beyond, you know, as the sport enters a bit of a weird phase now. We got a 12-team playoff. We've got Nick Saban leaving the sport, and the ripples that that is going to create throughout the college football landscape. You know, I think possibly also the impending collapse of the ACC is probably coming up. So who knows what's going on there, but, you know, Dan, I'd love to just get a feel for what you think Penn State is looking at kind of next year and beyond with this team and what we can expect.
Yeah, it's an interesting, like you said, it feels like an end of, in a lot of ways, an era of where even so we had the four team playoff, and then even before that with BCS, it was always ever down to just the two teams at the end of the day, right? And kind of left everyone else into these individual bowl games. So it really feels like that whole everything from 2000 all the way through till now is getting left behind. And that almost feels like that representative with Nick Saban kind of leaving the fold and retiring and everything else. It's like we're moving into this whole new world of competitive landscape that's really meant to, you know, not penalize teams as much that they could be very different from the beginning of their season to the end of their season. You know, we look back to some of the teams that we talked about during this CFP era and are like, that 2016 Penn State team that won the Big Ten championship was a completely different team than the first five games of the year, than their last and their run, right? And similar to other teams that we've seen who had some trip in the first half where they lost a weird game or they got blown out one time because it was just they just didn't have their guys in place, injuries, whatever it was. And this new world is hopefully going to allow for teams that maybe made that mistake or had that issue happen, still go into a postseason and have a shot at a title because they've turned it around and they found something at the end of the year. You know, this past year with FSU having what happened to them happen, and you know, just seeing a lot of really talented teams not really get a shot at it, even though it felt maybe deserved or something else, is a really interesting way to leave that behind and go into this new year. And then this whole new process that we're going to see, it does feel like, and I can't tell you how many articles, how many different areas I've seen that are like the team that benefits the most from this change is Penn State. Like, I don't think we have not been like highlighted other than anybody else. Maybe, I mean, maybe in Oregon, but they made it once. You know, there's other teams that have either gotten there because everybody else had a down year. We never got a break. The 1 or 2 years Ohio State was kind of down, Michigan was the best team in the country. And then every other year, Ohio State was a top four team in the country, mostly top three or top two. And almost every other group, except for the SEC, which had to compete with the Bama and LSU years, and then Georgia as of late, like every other conference, every other group got a break where one of their elite teams was just terrible for a couple of years. And that was your opening, that was your window. And basically, they're saying that Penn State never got that. And as much as you put it on the team, of course, to just win, you find a way to win, and that's how you get in. It's going to be really interesting to see how that changes also the recruiting mindset of just because we lose a 1-point game in the fourth quarter to Ohio State does not mean that we can't go play for a national championship. That changes recruiting outlook. It really does. Because that all of a sudden, the dream of still winning a national championship isn't dependent on a singular game against another top four team. It's dependent on what your entire season brings together and gets you into that postseason. And some people say it makes the regular season matter less. I don't see that happening. There's just so many competitive teams and so much to play for. I think it's just going to create a really strong pathway to get there. And then again, anything can happen in these games, and we've seen it over and over again.
First of all, as far as the devaluing of the regular season, I'm not going to pretend that a 12-team playoff will have no drawbacks. I think overall it is good for the sport at this point, though. I think it will help with the opt-out issue. I think in general the heaviest opt-outs are coming from those teams that are like first team out of the playoff to like the 15th ranked team in the country. The teams that like are good enough to be disappointed they didn't make it to a playoff and have enough NFL talent to be opting out, you
Right.
probably won't be seeing that. I think in general, the big changes in the sport right now, I think largely benefit Penn State. They do. Obviously the 12-team playoff benefits Penn State because of how many times, like I think they would have made it like 5 times in the past decade,
Yeah.
and didn't make any. I think Nick Saban obviously leaving Alabama is good for Penn State. Do I think it's gonna be a massive impact? Probably not, but like the best coach in the history of the sport leaving a team that like you might potentially see in the postseason now
Can't be
is,
bad.
yeah, it can't be a bad thing. I don't think James Franklin is a serious candidate for that job, by any means. I'd be a little, so I listen, it's maybe the best job in college sports, so like it wouldn't be. If God forbid he did actually get an offer, it wouldn't be like, what was he thinking going? But like, talk about how much less job security he'd have down there than
Yes.
Penn State,
Oh
because it's
my.
a lot less.
Who wants to follow that?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
And then, I think the 12-team playoff is good for the sport because yeah, maybe the regular season has a little less value now, but college football currently has far and away the worst postseason in all of sports. By not even close. Why, what other major sport has a postseason that the best players don't play in?
Right.
That large swaths of the fan base call meaningless outside of 3 games.
Yeah. I mean, even other college sports. I mean, go to pretty much any other college sport. It's what makes the NCAA tournament so amazing in basketball. It's what makes the Frozen Four and that hockey tournament they have
March
so great. I
Madness.
mean, you get these guys back to compete for a championship, and that drives them to get this great competition leading all the way in. It's one of the few ones that you don't get to see. And yes, football lives in its own world because you don't play 50 games, you only play 11 or 12. But still, it's too limiting. And like you're noting, to the point where 90% of your postseason is devalued by players, by fans, by, I mean, that's terrible. I mean, you should still be getting an insane level of commitment and viewership and everything to postseason. Even when a vast amount of your field has been eliminated, which is what it's going to become a little bit better on, is that elimination is a little bit less like, oh, you're not one of the top four teams. It's a better terminology, I think. But yeah, that's a weird problem. It's a weird issue to have for such a popular in-season sport where they're putting up in some of their best games of the season, they're putting up numbers that are similar to the NFL in terms of viewership and in terms of popularity on social media. And then you have a postseason that is so small, is so narrowly focused. And it's surprising that it took as long as it did. Obviously some people pushing back on going to eight teams or doing something sooner, and this is where we ended up. But yeah, it's interesting that the sport is now choosing to go in this direction finally. And I think the first couple of years are going to be very revealing as to does it produce something different and new and unique, or do we end up with the same four teams at the top anyway? I'm really excited to see what that brings, because that's definitely going to then shape the future of how recruits look at it, how divisions get formed yet again. SEC and Big Ten expanding, are we moving towards two super divisions, or will it create some sort of new regional breakup because of what happens across the 12 team? I don't know. It's going to be telling on how that plays out.
Yeah, what one thing I do want to touch on though is like with all the talk of like how often Penn State would be in the playoff in this 12-team field, I don't think this is like some slam dunk that like Penn State is just going to be a perennial playoff team now.
Right.
I mean, you saw what happened this year. The only three times Penn State played a decent team, it was ugly. And they're adding a team that was just in the national championship and two recruiting powerhouses to this
Yeah.
conference. I mean, I think all three of them going forward are very beatable for Penn State, but this is not a situation where we can just sit back and go, "Hey, keep this same process going and we'll be there." No. This team, this program has to get better. James Franklin has to get better at recruiting certain positions, at in some in-game coaching stuff, at big time play. And let's be very, I don't like being the guy who like criticizes college kids. I understand that they are all better at football than I am at anything. I get that. But like, you have to talk about it on the relative scale of where they're playing right now. If Penn State wants to succeed in 2024 and beyond, Drew Aller is going to have to be a different guy next year. The quarterback that played for Penn State this season is not going to cut it if Penn State even wants to sniff a championship. And the most worrying part about his game to me was the fact that when the lights were brightest, he was at his absolute worst. Terrible against Ohio State until the game was out of reach. Terrible against Michigan until one drive when the game was out of reach. Terrible against Ole Miss until the game was out of reach. That, I'm sorry, something's got to change there.
I mean, the lights are only going to get brighter. I mean, they have more big stage games with USC coming in, with Washington coming in. I mean, it's no longer going to be just two games a year that the lights get bright, and maybe an out of conference game, depending on if that conference game we scheduled or 10 years ago is still a relevant team, right? We didn't get national championship Auburn, we got 6-6 Auburn 1 year. But regardless, guys are going to need to understand that it is, yeah, that there are going to be massive games, home, away, et cetera, and expectations will be to get there, but it is definitely not a given. I completely agree with you on that. I think it's only going to bolster competition around the country because it now feels more accessible, which all of a sudden makes it that much more difficult because every team feels like they have a realistic shot. And honestly, at times in the four team, that didn't always feel like it was the case. It didn't always feel like you had a realistic shot because of what division you were in or where you were sitting. I think the 12 team makes it so that most teams, unless you are bottom of the barrel, feel like they have a realistic shot to get into that. And that is just, I think that's just going to level up a lot of teams. And yeah, this team has to realize that it is going to be a battle with this expanded Big Ten and with what the landscape is going to become. And that definitely cannot be a given. I completely agree with you. It's going to have to be a different, improved team with a different mentality next year.
Yeah. And guys, unfortunately, I do have to hop off because I'm supposed to be working right now and I have to go run a work meeting. But it is always fun talking Penn State football with you, Dan, and with all of you. Hopefully bring you guys some more stuff during the off season, some more transfer portal recruiting, maybe a little wrestling and basketball here and there, some other
Ooh.
sports. But as always, looking forward to 2024 and see what this program can do. And we are.
New year, new era, we are.